void beyond the sky. And one god took his place beside the door of the house of the unknown god to usher every soul inside. These are the three fathers, Grandfather Bones, the Salt Sea, and the Warden. Eventually, the new gods rose up against their parents, a war so fierce that it fractured the land and created the islands of Cadmus as we know them today. And because the new gods could not put an end to their parents, they created Tanria, a prison on Earth. Over time, the old gods lost the will to go on and begged the unknown god to let them take their place as stars on the altar of the sky, like their parents and their parents' parents before them. The Warden came then and cut a door into the mist of Tanria to let them out, and he sealed it shut behind them. Grandfather Bones made them a boat and sailed the old gods across the Salt Sea, where the unknown god forgave them and welcomed them home and set them on the altar of the sky. There are still war and greed, envy and fear, and all the dark, sad things that the old gods put into the world. Once those things entered our hearts, there was no removing them, even if the gods who created them are long gone. All we can hope to do in our short lives is to live well and honor the gifts our mothers and fathers and the new gods gave us, and willingly return to the unknown god when we sail the Salt Sea, and Grandfather Bones returns our body to the earth, and the Warden opens the door to our home in the void beyond the sky. Mercy stood below the skylight, contemplating the vastness of the unknown god and the smallness of her earthly worries, before she chose an alcove for prayer. As a motherless child, she usually prayed at the altar of one of the three mothers. Today, however, she made her way to the alcove of the Warden, the god of doorways, of exits and leave-takings and endings. His icon showed a two-faced deity, a being who gazed both inward and outward. She had loved all the colorful illustrations in a child's book of the gods, old and new, but the Warden's picture had been her favorite. She loved the way he opened the door to the house of the unknown god as if it led to an interesting new beginning as much as an ending. Mercy placed one of Zeddy's leftover mini souffles on the god's altar and hoped the Warden knew what a sacrifice it was. Those things were delicious. Then she lit a candle and took a seat in one of the pews.
"A door is closing, and I'm not sure how to find a new beginning once it does," she told the god in her mind. "If you have any guidance on this one, I'd appreciate it."
Mercy sensed someone sit down beside her. She turned to find Lillian gazing up at the death god's icon. "The Warden? Interesting choice." Mercy shrugged, and the sisters sat in silence. After a few minutes passed, Lillian asked,
"Why didn't you tell me or Zeddy about that offer?"
Mercy stared at the forlorn souffle on the altar and shrugged again.
"Because you knew that if Pop found out about Zeddy and me, he might decide to take it? That sounds about right. That's not fair to him, or to Zeddy, or to me and Danny. It's not your decision to make alone. And if you think about it, it's not fair to you either. Your entire universe revolves around the business, but there's more to life than dead people."
"I know, but..."
Mercy gazed at the Warden's two faces. As a death god, he looked toward the future and toward the afterlife. But as the god of introspection, he looked inwardly with his second set of eyes.
"That doesn't seem like such a terrible thing to me."
Lillian seemed as if she might say more. Instead, she changed the subject entirely.
"Want to go key shopping after this?"
It felt like forgiveness, and Mercy's lips curved up.
"For the baby?
Since someone let the cat out of the bag, I may as well start thinking about a birth key." Mercy's brief smile turned into a grimace of regret.
"Sorry about that. I was going to tell everyone this weekend anyway. It's not like I can hide it anymore. But you're still a jerk."
That was definitely Lil's brand of forgiveness. Mercy kissed her cheek. After Lillian made her offering to the Bride of Fortune, they walked arm in arm up Main Street to Mimi's gift shop.
"So, these letters," Lil said, as they sidled to the glass display case, where gold and silver keys shone on a bed of blue velvet.
"Oh boy,"
I can't believe you didn't tell me about it. There's nothing to tell. You are a lying liar who lies. Start from the beginning.
It came as a relief to tell Lillian about her secret friend, as if simply acknowledging the man's existence made him real. By the time Mercy finished, Lil had narrowed down the key choices to 3.
You really like this guy, she surmised, saying the thing that Mercy would not let herself think.
But there was no denying it, especially when Lillian saw through her no matter what she said.
I know that probably seems stupid, she admitted.
To be honest, yeah, it does. It's easy to like someone on paper, but that's because you can curate yourself for him, and he's doing the same thing. You two don't know the first thing about each other.
But we do, Mercy said.
And then she thought of all the banalities she kept out of her letters, the boring details of everyday life that formed a huge chunk of who she was.
This whole thing is a bad idea, Lillian continued,
moving one of the keys to the reject pile.
If you're lonely, find someone in reality. It's like you said, I've been taking care of you and Zeddy and Pop in the business for years, and I don't regret it. But those letters, they're the one thing in my life that's for me. I get that. But letters are made of paper, and that seems like a pretty flimsy foundation for a solid relationship to me. So either meet this guy in the flesh and find out if he's a decent human being, or move on.
They both turned their attention to the two keys remaining on the counter, one of which would be consecrated when the baby was born.
This one, Lillian declared, holding up the winner.
It wasn't the one Mercy would have chosen, but Mercy wasn't the one having a baby.
That one, she agreed.
When she got home, she sat at her desk, which had once belonged to her mother, and took out a pen and a sheet of stationery. Dear friend, she wrote, but got no further. She thought of her prayer to the warden, and she looked to the door of her apartment for inspiration. If her life had run a different course, if Mom were still alive, if Nathan had never cheated on her, if Zeddy had wanted to be an undertaker, if a million other things had or had not happened, there might have been an altar there beside it, a place for a new family with new keys and new beginnings. She expected her hand to shake with the nerves as she set pen to paper again, but it was remarkably steady. I think we should meet.
Chapter 14. Hart was stretched out on a cot in the barracks, his long legs crossed at the ankles, his feet hanging off the end, his head propped up against the wall, as he read an interlibrary loan book, The Almost War of Leona and Medora, and the Much Maligned Purpose of Governance in the Early Federation, by the light of the early evening sun eking in through one of the small windows. Duckers had made it through training, which meant that Alma could now assign Hart and his apprentice to a sector on the tour schedule. They'd be pulling the day shift in W-26 for the next week, while Banneker and Ellis patrolled in the evenings, which meant they'd stay in the barracks at night rather than camp out. Hart thought that Duckers would be thrilled by the prospect of interacting with marshals other than himself and sleeping in an actual building with a roof over his head. But his apprentice slumped on his own cot with an unread Gracie Goodfist comic in front of him, and he was being unusually taciturn. Hart should have enjoyed the respite from Duckers's incessant jabbering. Instead, it was aggravating him to no end. "You're not talking," he said over the top of his book. "Usually, you never shut up. What's the matter with you?"
"Have you ever heard of a drudge cluster, sir?"
Hart glanced over the top of the book to study Duckers's troubled mien. You should have seen this coming, but he found himself wrong-footed. He buried his nose between the pages again, as painful memories flickered across his memory. "I'm guessing some old-timer scared the shit out of you with a harrowing tale.
This morning in the commissary, I asked Marshal Hurd how he lost his ear, and he said he got caught in a drudge cluster 8 years ago.
Every veteran has some bullshit story about getting caught in a drudge cluster. And that's what it is, bullshit. They're inflating the numbers to make themselves look good, Hurd especially, so don't worry about it.
He said that drudges have been teaming up more and more lately, attacking people in groups of three or four all over Tanria. 10 or more drudges constitute a cluster. 3 or 4 does not a cluster make. A single well-trained marshal can take out a handful of drudges without too much trouble. Have you ever been caught in a cluster? Hart gave up on reading. He tucked the worn leather bookmark Bill had given him eons ago between the pages, set the book aside, and answered Duckers' question with another question. Have you noticed that no marshals are assigned to Sector 28?
No.
Well, they're not. It doesn't even have a station designation. Know why?
No, sir.
Hart consulted his pocket watch, which had belonged to his grandfather, and decided there was time enough before sunset to reach the boundary line of Sector 28. Saddle up, and I'll show you. Less than an hour later, he led his apprentice on Equimaris back to a ridge overlooking a ravine directly below and a wide meadow in the distance. At the center of this field stood a whitewashed 2-story farmhouse that Hart knew his apprentice could not see, just as no one but Hart could see the souls of the dead floating around it. This is the western boundary line of Sector 28. There have been 5 honest-to-gods drudge clusters reported since Tanria's opening 25 years ago. One was on that ridge to the southeast. A marshal died that night. Another was in that gully. 2 marshals went down. One was against the cliffs down there. Every marshal involved died, so we don't know for sure that there was a drudge cluster that day. One was in those trees to the northwest. Everyone got away that time, and one was on that field. A good marshal lost his life that night. Hart could recall with crystalline clarity Bill's anguished cries as the drudges tore into him, but he kept himself composed for Duckers' sake. Every drudge cluster has happened within a 2-mile radius of that meadow, so don't get any closer to it than you are now, and you'll be fine. Got it?
Yes, sir.
Good. He reached out and patted Duckers on the back, and was gratified to watch the load lighten from the kid's shoulders. The sun set as they rode to the barracks, and the painter coated Duckers' face in warm light, making him appear younger than usual. An affectionate pang shot through Hart's chest, and he wondered if Bill had felt this way about him. Back then, he had thought of his mentor as if Bill had been born a middle-aged man, with a complete and perfect understanding of the world. Now that Hart had an apprentice of his own, he couldn't imagine that he exuded that kind of unquestionable expertise. And yet, he couldn't help but wonder if Duckers thought as highly of him as he had thought of Bill. Bill, who had left a wife and child in Honeck and had never mentioned them to Hart. By the time they returned to the barracks and stabled the Equimaris, he was mired in memories of his mentor, a reminder that he could push away the past from time to time, but he'd never truly outrun it.
Have you ever been to Sector 28, sir?
Duckers asked as Hart fried up eggs for dinner on the old wood stove. Hart was tempted to lie, but the thought of being dishonest with Duckers didn't sit well with him.
Yep, in the early days of the Marshals, before we knew better. You didn't answer my question before. Have you ever seen a drudge cluster?
Again, Hart was tempted, sorely tempted. But his hesitation answered Duckers' question without his having to open his mouth. No point in denying it now. The drudge cluster on the meadow. That's how I lost my first partner.
Dang, sir. Sorry.
There was a note of admiration in Duckers' voice to go along with his condolences. Hart knew he didn't merit it. It was a long time ago. Hart gave his full attention to the eggs and hoped Duckers would take the hint and stop talking about drudge clusters. He didn't.
Why are drudges more dangerous there?
No idea. This time, Hart lied without hesitation. He'd never even told Alma about the house and the souls or what had happened the night Bill died. He plated the eggs with some beans and toast, but his worst memories lingered, haunting him, robbing him of his appetite.
Now you're the one not talking,
Duckers pointed out as they sat down to eat. I never talk much.
Yeah, but you're not talking is extra mopey tonight.
Hart was saved by Basarius's bellowing outside.
Knock, knock, mail delivery.
The Nimkillum stepped into the barracks, the earring glinting in his tall ear.
3 for the kid and 1 for you, loser.
Hart's heavy heart lifted as he took his friend's letter from the rabbit's paw, while Duckers got out coins from the tin where they kept the tip money and poured Basarius a cup full of whiskey.
Extra tonight, right, sir?
He asked Hart, referring to their special arrangement wherein they bribed the rabbit to come back the following night to pick up any letters they wanted to send, since there weren't any Nimkillum boxes inside Tanria.
Yep,
Hart answered as he loosened the flap of the envelope. He loved this moment, the anticipation before finding out what his friend had to say to him, the silky sound of good paper sliding free, the rustle as he unfolded the letter, the first view of cursive dancing its looping slant across the page. And then he read the first 2 lines.
Dear friend, I think we should meet.
Hart's ears started ringing as the meaning of his friend's words sank in.
You okay?
Duckers asked him, adding sir as an afterthought. Fine.
Your eggs are getting cold?
The thought of eating his cold eggs nauseated him. He stood so abruptly, he knocked over his chair. I'm going to take a piss.
Sure you are.
Gods, he knew he was in trouble when a 19-year-old could see right through him. He stepped outside and read the letter in the scant light after sunset.
Dear friend, I think we should meet. I know it may not be possible if we discover that we live miles or oceans apart. And if I'm being perfectly honest, there's a part of me that doesn't want to meet you in real life, that wants to go on presenting my best self to you on paper. But I'm beginning to wonder if a relationship made of letters makes us little more than paper dolls. If we are going to be friends, true friends, shouldn't we know each other as people, with all our faults and foibles included? It may be that you don't want to meet me in person, and believe me, I would understand if you don't. But if you do, honestly, I don't know how to finish that sentence, so I won't. Sincerely, your friend.
Troubles with your broad?
Basarius's voice cut through Hart's spiraling panic. To Hart's consternation, the rabbit hadn't left yet and was lounging in one of the deck chairs outside the barracks, savoring his whiskey. Broad? Who talks like that?
Messengers for the old gods who find themselves relegated to a life of miserable mail delivery for eons until they disappear and maybe, maybe become stars in the night sky?
Right. Hart dropped into the chair beside Basarius.
Those were the days when the old gods lived it up and let you say whatever you wanted.
Sounds like an enlightened time. Basarius sucked his enormous front teeth.
What's wrong with you? You're pissier than usual, pissy pants.
Hart clutched the letter and thought, what the fuck? If he didn't have any human beings to confide in, he might as well pour his heart out to an Nimkillum. There was nothing to lose here, because Basarius wasn't a part of his life. Was he? Hart held up the letter. My friend wants to meet.
So? That's a good thing, isn't it?
No. What if she doesn't like me in real life? Not exactly Mr. Warm and Fuzzy. Even you can't stand me, and you're an asshole.
Basarius preened, slicking back his ears.
Thank you very much.
Or what if she sees what I am and it makes her feel, I don't know. Or worse, what if she can only see this?
He pointed to his unnatural gray eyes.
So you've never met this bird before?
No, that was kind of the point.
Sounds pointless to me.
Hart opened his mouth but found that he had no easy answer. Basarius nodded.
So basically, you want a girlfriend without having to put in the work of being a decent person in her presence. You can paint the best possible picture of yourself on paper and call it good.
No, we're 100% honest with each other.
Oh, so she knows that you're a grumpy-ass demigod marshalling Tanria?
Hart shifted in his chair.
No. So she doesn't know you at all. And what do you know about her?
Here, Hart perked up.
She likes music and romance novels and cake. She's smart and funny and you know next to nothing about her. Point less. This?
Viserys reached over and crinkled the paper in Hart's hand.
Is some flimsy-ass shit.
Knock it off. Hart tugged the letter out of the rabbit's paw.
Quit being a fucking coward and meet her.
The Nimkillum's blunt words twisted Hart's innards like the key of a wind-up toy.
What if it doesn't work out? What if we stop being friends? Then you can stop dicking around with letters and find the real person in real life to date.
Viserys's beady eyes softened.
You keep asking, what if this bad thing happens or that bad thing happens? How about, what if you two hit it off? What if she's the love of your life, dumbass? Thought about that?
It was as if the rabbit had let go of the wind-up key and set Hart's inner mechanics spinning. He swallowed and nodded.
Then go meet her, because you've only got one life to live. May as well make the most of it.
Viserys smacked him on the shoulder as if they were friends and grinned at him, revealing his broken tooth, before he walked away to finish his mail route.
I may have only one life to live, but who knows how long it's going to last?
Hart asked, but in a voice pitched too low for anyone to hear him but himself.
And how much of that life are you going to spend alone, you poor, pitiful bastard?
His own mind responded. With these uncomfortable questions pricking him from the inside, he returned to the barracks, where he found Duckers sitting on a cot, smiling over a letter from Zeddy, oblivious to Hart and the raging firestorm of emotion inside him. Hart got out paper and pen from his pack and sat at the table, pushing aside his cold eggs and beans.
I am taking advice from a drunk rabbit,
he marveled under his breath, as he began to write his reply to his friend.
Chapter 15. As she hummed under her breath, Mercy wished for the millionth time that there was room for a gramophone in the boatworks. She longed for music to drown out the deafening silence that had overtaken Birdsall and Son Undertakers. The Birdsalls did not argue often, so when they did so badly. Mercy had patched things up with Lil before her sister and Danny left on the delivery run Sorrowsday morning, but Pop continued to fume in his office, refusing to speak to her. And Zeddy had stopped coming into work altogether. A pall that had nothing to do with the death hung in the air. Such was the mood when Horatio arrived. Mercy knew better than to expect a reply from her friend on Saltsday when she had sent her letter on Sorrowsday, but she was disappointed all the same when no response from him arrived. Instead, Horatio handed her a thick envelope embossed with the Cunningham's Funeral Services logo, addressed to her personally. Ugh, she told the Nimkillum as she plunked a silver coin onto his outstretched wing. You are most welcome, darling, I'm sure, he huffed, before flitting off. Mercy could tell that she had offended him and would have to spend the next week buttering him up to make him civil again, but she couldn't bring herself to care. She tore into Cunningham's envelope and read the note card inside. Dear Mercy, I hope you will do me the honor of joining me for a cup of coffee at my office this afternoon at 2 o'clock. In addition to enjoying the pleasure of your company, I should like to bend your ear regarding an important matter of business. Yours sincerely, Curtis Cunningham. Mercy debated the pros and cons of accepting the invitation throughout the morning as she delivered Mr. Tomlinson's boated remains to the temple, stood respectfully in the foyer during the funeral, and wheeled him to the dock to take him to the shipyard for the burial service. On the one hand, she suspected Cunningham was setting a trap for her. On the other hand, she'd rather find out exactly what the other undertaker had up his sleeve, so that she could plan Birdsall and Son's counterattack. And so it was that at 1:45 in the afternoon, she cleaned herself up, traded out her coveralls for a dress, and sneaked out the front door, which was easy since Pop wasn't talking to her anyway. As she walked up the boardwalk to Cunningham's funeral services,
she whispered a prayer to the three fathers, with promises to steal Zeddy's next batch of profiteroles and offer them on all three altars if they would have her back during this meeting. Soon enough, she found herself seated in a plummy leather chair across from Curtis Cunningham, the acreage of his gleaming mahogany desk stretching between them. After a blessedly brief round of small talk and niceties and the offer of coffee, Cunningham got down to business, leaning back in his plummier leather chair and steepling his fingers. "Roy has been remarkably silent in regards to my offer. He did receive my offer, did he not?"
"Yes, Mr. Cunningham, he has your offer in hand," Mercy said curtly.
Irritated by the insinuation that she was trying to hide the letter from her father, and more irritated by the fact that she had, in fact, hidden it for quite some time from her siblings.
"And has a decision been reached?"
Mercy decided to toss aside the veneer of formality.
"Ask Pop, Curtis. He's the one who owns the business, not me."
"I'm not asking the person who owns the business. I'm asking the one who runs it."
Mercy offered no reply, but Cunningham, who had nothing to lose, felt free to continue, his tone light and chatty as he took up his hefty silver pen and began to play with it like a cat toying with a mouse.
"In the absence of a reply to my offer, I have decided to speed along your response for you."
Mercy couldn't shake the feeling that Cunningham was about to press a button under that behemoth of a desk and open a trap door beneath her chair. He slathered a kind, paternal smile across his pale, handsome face as he continued.
"Which is why I feel you should know that I have secured a deal with the Afton Lumber Company. In exchange for exclusive rights to all lumber appropriate for the construction of our handcrafted line of funereal boats, Cunningham's Funeral Services will offer all its workers an extremely attractive line of prepaid packages at a 30% discount."
Mercy sat up, splashing coffee onto her lap and burning her thigh. Afton was the sole supplier of lumber on the western border. If Birdsall and Son lost access to their inventory, she would have to source materials from the other side of Tanria, or possibly overseas. The cost of transport alone would sink them. She set the cup on Cunningham's desk and willed it to leave a ring in the wood.
"You can't do that," she said as calmly as she could.
"It's already done. The new arrangement will go into effect next calendar year, as will Cunningham's complete control over the lumber market of Western Bouchong."
"That's a monopoly. We'll take you to court."
"Oh? Do you have a lawyer on retainer? Because I do."
Mercy slowly deflated into the ostentatiously expensive leather of her seat. The Birdsalls barely kept their books in the black. They couldn't afford a lawyer, and they most definitely couldn't afford to lose their primary supplier. Cunningham leaned forward with faux concern, resting his forearms on the desk.
"Mercy, you did your best, and I am so proud of you for what you've accomplished. You always were a good girl. But Birdsall and Son won't survive this. If you go out of business, where will you be then? Or your father, or Zeddy, or Lillian? Take the money, sweetheart, for their future and for yours."
Despite the coffee stain on her skirt, Mercy rose from the chair with as much dignity as she could muster.
"I'm not a good girl or a sweetheart, Curtis, and you don't have the right to be proud of me. Especially since I know we wouldn't be having this conversation unless you were terrified of me. Which you should be. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have a business to run."
Her burst of bravado had abandoned her completely by the time she stood on the boardwalk outside Cunningham's Funeral Services. Her walk back to Birdsall and Son seemed far too short, but she was unwilling to hide the truth from her father again. She knocked on the door to his office and was answered with a gruff,
"What is it?"
She opened the door, but Roy refused to acknowledge her.
"I spoke with Curtis Cunningham. He's come to an agreement with Afton Lumber. We're going to have to source our wood from another vendor."
She watched as her words sank in and understanding overtook her father's face. He cleared his throat, but he said nothing. Since neither Curtis Cunningham's offer nor his arrangement with Afton Lumber changed the fact that Mercy needed to wrap and salt at least 2 more bodies today, she returned to the boatworks and left her father to stew at his desk. Pop locked up and went home without popping in to say goodbye. Mercy doubted she was going to be welcomed at the family dinner table, especially with Lil and Danny gone, so she dragged herself upstairs and made a plate of subpar macaroni and cheese for the second night in a row, after which she drank too much wine and dove into the romance novel that she had checked out from the library. She had hoped that the steamy bits would distract her. Instead, she wound up feeling her own lack of steam acutely. Tossing the book to the side, she turned out the light and slept fitfully, with Leonard snoring beside her. The following morning, Mercy opened the front door before Horatio had a chance to knock, and greeted him with a mimosa. It was made with the overly sweet sparkling wine of Northern Bouchon, but there wasn't much she could do about the unavailability of a decent vintage in the wilds of the tannery and border towns. "I'm sorry I was short with you yesterday," she told him as she handed him the flute. The Nimkilim sniffed, but it was a forgiving sniff. He accepted the proffered glass and took a delicate sip. "Orange juice does mask a world of evil, doesn't it?" At least there was one being in this world besides Leonard who wasn't furious with her. "Thank you," said Mercy. "Prepare to double your gratitude," he said with a wink, as he handed her the letter she had been anticipating on pins and needles. Her squeal of delight was so high-pitched that Horatio drawled, "Do be careful, or you'll wind up with a pack of feral dogs scratching at your door." Mercy tore into the envelope as Horatio waddled out the door.
"Dear friend, we are always honest with each other, so here it goes. I want to meet you, very badly, but I am also terrified to meet you. Not because I worry that I won't like you, I'm certain that I will, but because I worry that you won't like me. I suspect that I make a better paper doll than a human being, and I feel very strongly that you deserve a friend more worthy of you than I am in reality. Are you sure you want to meet me? The grouchy, doesn't know how to live a little, me? Best, your friend. P.S. I live in Bouchon. P.P.S. Telling you that much makes me break out into a cold sweat."
Bouchon. All this time, they had been inhabiting the same island and never knew it. Mercy wasn't sure that she believed in fate, but this was beginning to feel like something that was meant to be. She raced up to her apartment to write her reply. Chapter 16. Dear friend, I'm terrified too, and I'm also worried that you won't like me when you meet me in person. That's only natural, isn't it? And would you want to be friends with a self-centered jerk who assumes everyone loves them anyway? Of course you wouldn't, and I wouldn't either. Anything worth doing in this life requires a leap of faith, and I have faith that our friendship can exist beyond these letters, despite all the faults and weaknesses of our flesh and blood selves, which is why I want to meet you, to know you better. Let us be brave. Sincerely, your friend. P.S. I also live in Bouchon.
Dear friend, for you, I will be brave. Are you free next Warden's Day? There's a place in Mayetta called the Little Wren Cafe. I can be there by 7 p.m. Can you read this? My hand is shaking so badly, I can hardly hold the pen. Your friend.
Dear friend, next Warden's Day, 7 o'clock p.m., at the Little Wren Cafe in Mayetta, it is. I'm so excited to meet you. I'll wear yellow, so you'll be able to spot me easily. Yours giddily, your friend.
Dear friend, I'll be there, but I won't be wearing yellow. My entire wardrobe is A, very limited, and B, extremely drab. You can tell me to live a little when we finally meet, in person. Your friend. P.S. I have mentioned that I'm terrified, right?
Chapter 17. Each day that brought Warden's Day closer made Hart's nerves ratchet higher.
By the time Wisdom's Day rolled around, he had no patience left to spare for poor duckers, which was why he went apoplectic when he spied the wad of wrinkled paychecks in his apprentice's open rucksack.
"You have got to be kidding me. What the fuck, kid?"
Duckers winced.
"Yeah, I was going to get to that."
"Sometime this decade?"
"I mean, sure, of course."
"You do have a bank account, correct?"
When Duckers bit his lip, Hart repeated stridently,
"Correct?
My mom's going to help me set one up whenever she can get away for a visit."
"If you haven't cashed your paychecks, how did you buy a prepaid funeral package?"
Duckers bit his lip again and scraped the toe of his boot through the leaf litter at his feet.
"You're dating an undertaker," said Hart.
He was about to unleash a steady stream of exasperated profanity when he realized that a branch of Federated Banking was located in Mayetta. If he took Duckers to open a bank account tomorrow, he could send him on his way to buy a prepaid funeral package and ID key at Birdsall & Son, which meant he could get his apprentice out of the way early and give himself enough time to get ready for dinner. It was as if the clouds above had cleared and a ray of sunshine were blazing directly upon his head, with the hymn of the Bride of Fortune filling his ears. He was almost giddy when he dragged Duckers by the shirt collar into Alma's office the following day.
"What's up?" she asked.
Hart held up the uncashed, undeposited paychecks.
"This child has no bank account."
Alma burst out laughing.
"Ha ha, very funny," Duckers muttered.
"Mind if we head out early to get this dipstick set up?"
"Hey,"
Duckers protested.
"You got it," said Alma.
Hart succeeded in keeping a stupidly happy, telltale grin from spreading across his face. Now he was free to fret about his rendezvous with his soon-to-be-known friend for the next 7 hours. Those 7 hours did not, however, pass uneventfully. Duckers dawdled at the station after lunch, comparing notes with another apprentice over 3 helpings of cake, until Hart began to worry he'd have to take the kid out of there at Rapier Point. When they finally did hit the road, Hart's auto duck blew a tire 15 miles outside of Mayetta, setting them back more. And the process of getting Duckers' bank account set up took a full hour longer than Hart had anticipated. By the time they got to the hotel, it was well past 6 o'clock. As Duckers preened in the hotel room mirror, Hart tried to examine his own appearance without looking like he was examining his appearance, and failed miserably. He finally gave up and butted Duckers out of the way so that he could stand in front of the mirror like a normal person getting ready for a... what? A meeting? A get-to-know-ya? A date? Hart assessed his reflection, studying the harsh lines of his face and the startling paleness of his irises. His efforts at combing down his messy blonde hair did nothing to improve or soften his appearance. She wasn't going to like him.
"Everything okay, sir?"
Duckers peered over his shoulder at Hart's reflection. The kid had never asked him about his eyes or his parents, or what it was like to be a demigod. He'd simply taken him as he was, and all of a sudden, Hart was incredibly grateful for it.
"I need a favor," he admitted.
"All right, what?"
He pulled his watch from his pocket. 6:56. "Come with me." He took Duckers by the arm and pulled him into the hall, locking up the room behind him.
"But I'm going to see Zeddy.
This won't take long."
Hart ushered a moderately resistant Duckers out the front door of the hotel and one block over to the Little Wren Cafe, arriving at 7 o'clock on the nose.
"Okay, what's this favor?"
"I need you to look through the window and find a woman dressed in yellow."
"Okay, why am I doing this?"
"Just do it."
"Not unless you tell me what's going on."
"It's none of your business."
Hart resisted the urge to loosen his collar.
"That whole bank account thing was a cover, wasn't it? You're here to meet a woman."
Hart said nothing, but Duckers' whole being lit up with amusement.
"It's your letter-writing friend, isn't it?"
"Fine, yes. Now would you look?
Because you want to know if she's ugly so you can ditch her?"
"No."
Of course, it had occurred to Hart that this woman might not be physically attractive. But the truth was that he was far more worried about getting ditched than being the ditcher.
I can't believe you dragged me here to case the joint for you, you big chicken.
Duckers tucked his hands into his armpits and flapped his elbows.
Bark, 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 bark. Who's a big chicken?
Mortified, Hart pushed him none too gently toward the window.
Just look. I'm on it.
Duckers made a show of flapping his elbows as he waddled up the front steps of the Little Wren Cafe to peer into the restaurant's picture window.
Do you see her? Give me a sec. Well, would you calm your...
Oh my gods.
The sinister glee in that oh my gods filled Hart's veins with dread. What?
No way.
What? He begged. When Duckers spun around, he had pure, unadulterated joy painted all over his face.
Ha!
He cackled so loudly, the sound echoed off the neighboring buildings.
Shh! This is the greatest day of my life, crowed Duckers.
So help me gods, I'm going to throttle you. What does she look like?
What would you say if I told you she looks a lot like Mercy Birdsall?
Duckers answered, traipsing down the steps in a series of jovial hops.
I would say kill me now.
Mercy's pretty, sir, you have to admit that.
I most certainly do not.
Well, if you don't find Mercy Birdsall attractive, you're not going to like this lady.
Really?
Yeah, because she is Mercy Birdsall. Boom!
Duckers danced in triumph in front of Hart.
Who was right? I was right.
What?
The boardwalk seemed to spin like a carnival ride beneath Hart's feet.
Your pen pal is the one, the only Mercy Birdsall of Birdsall and Son Undertakers. Who you like?
On each of the last three words, Duckers poked Hart in the chest over the hollowed out spot where his beating heart should be.
No, Hart breathed, his lungs deflating.
Yes.
That can't be right.
See for yourself.
Hart's ankles and knees went rubbery as he made his way up the stairs and peered through the window. There was Mercy, wearing the same bright yellow dress she'd worn the day he'd walked into Birdsall and Son over 4 years ago. She sat toward the back, craning her neck, glancing eagerly about her. He had never before seen her with her hair down. Now the dark locks curled about her shoulders, glinting auburn where the candlelight hit it. And for one instant, he forgot that he couldn't stand her. He could think only about how lovely she looked. And then reality sank in like the teeth of a feral dog. All this time, he had been writing letters to Mercy Birdsall. Mercy, with her heartache and her insults and her fake dimples, as if she were thrilled to smile in the face of death. Had she known it was him all along? Was this a sick joke? The cruelty of it made his chest burn from the inside. Hart's whole body went so rigid, he could barely bring himself to go down the stairs. His boots hit each tread with a heavy clunk.
Aren't you going in? Duckers asked.
Nope.
Hart continued to walk in the direction of the hotel.
You're standing her up?
By now, Duckers was meeting him stride for stride, talking at his shoulder.
Yep.
At least go in there and come clean so she's not waiting around all night.
Weren't you going to take the autoduct to eternity?
Better get going.
Sir.
Duckers put out a hand to stop him, but Hart jerked away.
Don't tell anyone about this. Not Zeddy, not her. No one. You don't breathe a word of this ever. Promise me.
With all due respect, sir, you're being a dick.
Hart had steel to spare this evening, and he sank all of it into the glare he unleashed on Duckers.
Fine, I promise. Happy now?
No, Hart was not happy. He was the opposite of happy. He turned his back on Duckers and walked away, but behind him, he heard his apprentice shout,
"Bark, bark, bark!"
He kept walking anyway, listening to the familiar squeal of his autoduct's front door as Duckers got in and slammed it shut. The engine turned over, and the wheels susurrated in reverse before Duckers pulled away down the paved main street of Mayetta. And then Hart was alone on the boardwalk, and alone inside his skin. He couldn't make the friend in his letters match up with the woman who had spent the past 4 years sniping at him from behind the counter of Birdsall and Son. It had to be a malicious prank. Somehow, some way, Mercy must have found out he had written that first letter and had toyed with him, tricked him, lured him here to make a fool of him. She hated him this much. Or could he have been wrong about her? Could Mercy Birdsall have written the words that Hart had read so many times he had committed them to memory? Could she have poured her heart out to him without knowing who he was? Could she have liked the man she had met in his letters? The image of Mercy sitting by herself in the Little Wren Cafe filled his mind. He saw her watching the door, hopeful, her yellow dress bright in the atmospheric dimness of the restaurant, her shiny hair skimming her shoulders, her glasses glinting in the candlelight. Hart was almost certain her letters were a horrible gag, but there was a chance, however slim, that Mercy was anxiously waiting for her friend to show up. Guilt percolated inside him, filling him up. No one would describe Hart as nice, but he wasn't cruel either. If the letters weren't a joke, if they were genuine and true, he couldn't leave her there, believing that her friend had stood her up. He had to face her. A pitiful mule of self-preservation escaped his throat, but his morals compelled his feet to deliver his body to the Little Wren Cafe. He willed a mask of disinterest over his face before he pushed in the door and stepped inside. A bell over the lintel announced his entrance, and Mercy looked up. And it was exactly as it had been the day they met, with Mercy like sunshine personified in her yellow dress, and every thought Hart had ever had in the course of his life emptying out of his brain and vanishing into thin air. His feet kept moving, and each step that brought him closer to Mercy made her big brown beautiful eyes go wider and wider behind her glasses. And then he was standing over her, and one thought finally took shape in his brain. I think I want this to be real. No, she breathed. No, no, no. What are you doing here? He knew that he needed to say something, but Mercy had injected the word you with enough vitriol to rust a hole in a tin roof, and he couldn't find a word in his head to save his life. I can't, cannot deal with you right now, heartache. I need you to not be here. But he had arranged to meet her at the Little Wren Cafe on Warden's Day at 7 o'clock, hadn't he? And here he was, albeit a few minutes late. But as Mercy tilted her head, staring past him toward the door, he understood that she could not entertain the idea that Hart Ralston was the man behind the pen. And somehow, that was worse than the notion that this had been a joke to her. Hello, Merciless, he said, a hard lump in his throat, making his voice gravelly. I have an important thing tonight, so can we not do this? Please, leave me alone. Feel free to never come back again, she told him in his memory. Hart scanned the restaurant full of happy people having happy conversations and living happy lives, and he wanted to light the place on fire. He fixed a nasty smile onto his face. Pretty crowded tonight. Mind if I join you?
Yes, I mind.
She pushed her purse toward the opposite place setting, trying to save the seat for someone who had already arrived. Whether she knew it or not, that chair was meant for Hart, and he sat in it.
Excuse me,
you're excused.
I'm meeting someone who is not you.
A bitter laugh pulsed through his throat as he pulled his watch from his pocket. At 7:10? Seems like a strange time to meet. Are they late?
None of your business, and I'll thank you to vacate that seat.
A waitress stopped at the table and asked Hart,
Can I get you anything?
No, he's going on his merry way, Mercy answered for him, her eyes doing their level best to flay him alive from across the table.
Why, yes, thank you. I'll take a cup of jasmine green tea, Hart told the waitress, deliberately giving himself away with his drink order. Mercy failed to notice.
She was too busy killing him in a variety of violent ways in her imagination.
"Leave," she said, seething.
Hart crossed his ankle over his knee, as casual as you please, when every muscle, vein, and bone in his body felt as if it were screaming in rage. "Tell you what, I'll keep you company until your friend comes along."
"Why would you want to keep me company? You hate me as much as I hate you."
Hate. He could almost see the word written across his white shirt in a blood splatter. "Hate's a strong word, Merciless. Do you really hate me?" "Say yes," Hart begged her in his mind. "Lay into me so that I can hate you too." But the front door opened with a chiming of bells, and Mercy looked past Hart with a hopefulness that sliced him from his guts to his throat. He turned toward the door and saw what Mercy saw, an elderly couple asking for a table. He turned in time to watch her sag with disappointment. "Not your friend, I take it?" Pointedly ignoring him, she reached into her purse, pulled out a book, and pretended to read. With each second that she refused to see him for who he was, a thunderous wrath built in his chest. He wanted her to hate his letter-writing self as much as she hated his flesh-and-blood self. He wanted to obliterate any foolish hope she'd been cherishing about her friend, the same way she was destroying his now. And then he could go back to the way he'd been before he'd ever set pen to paper and slid a ridiculous confession into a Nimkillum box. He checked his watch again. If your friend was supposed to meet you at 7, they've gone from being mildly late to very late. Pretty soon, it will be egregiously late.
Mind your own business.
He examined the spine of her novel. Enemies and lovers, huh?
It's a classic. But I'm sure you're one of those men who've never read it because you believe it's a drippy romance novel that tries to pass itself off as great literature.
That was exactly what he thought of Enemies and Lovers. Touché.
Gods forbid you read a love story and experience personal growth as a result.
Ah, yes. Nothing says personal growth like Eliza Cannondale, wasting away under her father's misogynistic roof, waiting for her demigod hero to sweep her off her feet.
I thought you've never read it.
I haven't, but I don't live in a cave.
Don't you?
She may as well call him a pathetically friendless loser again. The waitress appeared at his side, setting his order down before him.
Your tea, sir.
The steam billowed between them as Mercy leaned in, alight with fury.
I'll have you know that Eliza Cannondale takes control of her own life and requires no rescuing. And let me assure you that you only wish you had Samuel Dunn's strength of character.
And what kind of character does your, Hart checked his watch again, egregiously late friend have?
My friend has more decency in his pinky finger than a brute like you could dream of.
Hart took a delicate sip of tea with his pinky in the air to demonstrate his complete lack of brutishness. Mercy huffed as he set the cup on its saucer with a musical clink.
Maybe there are things about me that would surprise you, Merciless, if you bothered to scratch the surface.
How could she fail to recognize him when he was quoting their letters to her, daring her to know him for who he was? But Mercy snorted, oblivious to the truth sitting 3 feet in front of her.
Please, she scoffed. If I cut you open on my prep table, I'd probably find a rapier where a heart should be, and a bleak, grim, depressing novel that no one but you could possibly want to read lodged in your appendix.
It was as if Mercy had grabbed the blunt knife from her place setting and filleted him with it. He had come here tonight to do the right thing, only to find himself wounded and bleeding. He bared his teeth like a cornered animal when he spoke again. And this friend you're waiting on is a big-hearted, soulful paragon of human decency?
Yes, he is. He's kind and smart and funny and thoughtful.
And apparently he's invisible, because you sure as shit don't see him here.
Mother of sorrow's tears, he might as well be wearing a sign that said, "I'm your secret pen pal, Mercy," with an arrow pointing at his face.
What do you care, you self-serving, prickly, glowering nightmare of a man? Oh, excuse me, half-man, because who knows where your other half came from?
That barb shredded him so thoroughly, Hart could barely breathe.
"How very precise of you," he said in clipped syllables, feeling as if she had run him through with his own rapier.
The front bell rang again, and Mercy's eyes darted to the door, where three women came in together. This time, a tear slid down her cheek, salt water that stung all the gashes she had carved into Hart.
"Go, okay? Leave me alone."
"Gladly." His voice was chilly, but his insides were a conflagration. He took one last sip of tea before heading for the bar, where he paid for Mercy's drink as well as his, a parting shot accomplishing he knew not what. In his hotel room, he lay spread-eagle on the bed without bothering to pull down the coverlet. His friend, who, as it turned out, was not his friend at all, had told him he had a rapier in place of a heart. And maybe she was right. It was stabbing him in his bleak, grim, depressing novel of a soul.
Chapter 18. On All God's Day, Mercy argued with Lillian. All God's Day was, of course, Mercy's day off, but it was also the only day of the week without mail service. She didn't know how she was going to make it through the day without her friend's letter, explaining why he wasn't at the Little Wren Cafe last night. Because that letter would arrive tomorrow morning. She was certain of it. She went to Temple and once again sat before the icon of the warden. "Mom used to say that when the warden shuts a door, he always opens a window," she prayed to him. "But it feels like you've closed at least two more doors on me since the last time I was here. I don't mean to complain, but if you could point me toward a window or two, I'd be very grateful. Also, Zeddy's not talking to me, so I haven't been able to get my hands on his baking. The toaster pastry was the best I could do this morning, I swear." The god's two faces gazed ahead and behind, and it seemed to Mercy that the last place he was looking was at her. She made it in and out of the temple without running into a family member, but it was hardly surprising when, shortly after she returned to her apartment, she heard the front door open, followed by her sister's determined footsteps up the stairs.
"I can't believe you missed dinner last night," Lil declared when Mercy let her in. "It was delicious, by the way. Zeddy got his mitts on imported sole fillets. I don't usually like fish, but that sole was the best thing I've ever eaten. How does he do it?"
"No idea. Good for Zeddy. I'm beside myself with joy that he's found his calling," Mercy said flatly as she offered her sister a foil packet containing two jelly-filled pastries, the only breakfast-like substance in her apartment.
"So, where were you?"
"I had a date, kind of," Mercy admitted. Lil shrieked.
"Oh, with who?"
"With whom?" Mercy thought, her mind filling with her absent friend's familiar handwriting to correct Lillian's grammar. It sank her spirits lower.
"Was it the letter guy? Why didn't you tell me this the second you opened the door? I want details."
"He couldn't make it." Mercy took a bite of her pastry, and it crumbled in her mouth like sawdust. She didn't know why she kept buying them. They were always such a disappointment.
"He stood you up?"
"He couldn't make it," Mercy repeated. Lillian's pupils dilated into pinpricks of outrage, but Mercy didn't want her to be mad at her friend. She wanted her sister to direct that anger toward its rightful target.
"And then Hart Ralston saw me sitting alone and sat down at my table and was his usual horrible, insulting self."
Gallingly, Lillian fanned herself with a foil wrapper.
"I don't think I'd mind if Marshall Ralston sat at my table."
Mercy blinked at her, stunned by her sister's treachery.
"He's pure evil. In a very nice body. Lil, I know you hate the guy, but I never thought he was that bad. A bit gruff, maybe. Lots of demigods are. Probably sick of the way most people fawn all over them. He was always polite to me."
Lillian had already polished off the first pastry in the packet, and now tore into the second as if she were taking a bite out of Hart Ralston's impressive backside.
"Go ahead. Join the Heartache Fan Club. He never decided to loathe you for no reason. Don't you think it's weird the way you two instantly hated each other? What demigod in his right mind wouldn't fall for you?
Who said Hart Ralston is in his right mind? And I can't, for the life of me, figure out why you wouldn't swoon over a smoking hot marshal. Are you serious? Don't make me barf up my extremely disappointing breakfast. All I'm saying is that a tall, single, and extremely attractive Tanrian marshal who is standing before you in the flesh sounds a lot better than some letter-writing weirdo who stands you up. For the last time, he couldn't make it. Forget it. Sorry. Lillian threw up her hands as if she were the one who deserved to be exasperated. I came here to talk to you about Cunningham's offer, anyway. Mercy buried her face in her hands, muffling her voice as she answered. Then you can turn around and leave, because I am not in the mood. Well, when are you going to be in the mood? Because this is a decision that involves all of us. It's not yours to make alone. Alone. Maybe Mercy had more in common with her absent correspondent than she had initially thought. In many ways, alone was exactly what Mercy had been for years. And it seemed blisteringly unfair of the gods to allow the future of the family business that she had single-handedly kept up and running to be decided by committee. She let her hands fall away from her face and snapped, "Yeah, got it. Fine, be that way. But when Danny and I get back next week, we're having this out once and for all."